I walked out into the sunlight and went carefully down the ill-made stairs, moving toward John Harden, whose rifle was pointed at my eyes. As I approached, I prayed that John Harden's basic sweetness would break through the disfigured latitudes of his madness. The death of my mother is driving me nuts, I thought, so why should it surprise any of us that John Harden's having a hard time? "Put my mother back where she belongs, or I'm going to send you on an all-expense-paid trip to heaven." "Then you can raise Leah for me, John Harden," I shouted, nearing him. "You can tell her you shot her father down dead in the woods, and you can tell her bedtime stories the rest of her childhood, and put away money for her college education. Sharla's already killed herself, so Leah's used to not having a parent around. Of course, after killing Mom, leaving her in this condition, I don't care what you do to me. Just get out of my way, John Harden. Mom must have a fever of 105, and she's going to die in the next hour if we don't get her to a hospital. Are you trying to kill Mom?"
"No, Jack, I swear to God. I'm trying to save her, to help her. Ask Mom, wake her up. She knows what I'm trying to do. I forgot to pack aspirin, that's all. I love her more than anyone. Much more than any of you guys, she knows that."
"Then help us get her to someone who can save her," I said. "Please, please," said Dallas Dupree and T., and John Harden lowered the rifle. Even after we got her to the hospital, Lucy remained in the involuntary country of delirium. Again we hovered over her and whispered, "I love you, Mama," 1,000 times, in a litany of endless valentines, to ease her solitude and suffering. Beside her bed, the clear, foul-smelling chemotherapy once more dripped into the vein in her right arm. It burned as it entered and killed every blood cell it touched, good and bad. It eased its way along the highways that connected her organs like distant cities. Down again it took her to the sacristies of death. Her body turned inward on itself, and her vital signs wavered as her young doctor monitored each step of her descent. He took Lucy all the way down to the point of death, then stopped the chemotherapy treatment forever and left her withered, tormented body for Lucy herself to save. Though Dr. Steve Payton thought Lucy would die in the hospital on the night of her return, he underestimated the strength she brought to the task of survival. Hers was a body that had endured 5 hard labors and produced 5 baby boys who each weighed over 8 pounds. Twice that first night she almost died, and twice she came back. At the end of the second day, Lucy opened her eyes and saw my brothers and me surrounding her. We cheered and screamed so loudly, the nurses came rushing in to quiet us. Disoriented, she could not understand all the commotion we made, but she winked at us. Then she slept solidly for another 5 hours, then awoke again to our shouts of encouragement. After the second awakening, a distraught T slipped out of the room. I followed him out the back door of the hospital, into the clean air, and joined him on the bank of the river, above the green fringe of spartina grass. T was crying softly when I reached him.
"I'm not ready for this, Jack. I swear I'm not. There should be classes in this shit. A book needs to be written to tell me how to act and feel now. Every move I make seems phony to me. Even these tears seem fake, like I'm pretending to care more than I do. She shouldn't have brought us in this world if she knew we were going to have to sit around and watch her die a little at a time. It's not that I love her ass so much, either. Well, I think you older boys got the best of Mom, I really do. Somewhere along the line, she quit being a mother to us. Okay, so she ran down, no big deal. But this is killing me, and I don't know why. I even blame her for the way John Harden is. I think she didn't raise the little bastard, just watered him enough to grow. I'm sorry, I have no right to think any of this."
"Say anything you want," I said. "I think that's probably the best thing we can do while we're losing her." "She loves John Harden more than me for one lousy reason," T said, "because he's mentally ill and I'm not. Is that fair? I'm jealous because I'm not a goddamn schizophrenic. I get psycho-envy every time I think about it." "John Harden needs Mom to love him most," I tried to explain. "He's a special case."
"He's a nutbag," T said. "He practically kills Mom, and we pretend everything's fine just because John Harden forgot to keep his date with the Thorazine Clinic."
"He did what he could," I said. "I envy John Harden. We sit around saying prayers to a god we know won't listen to us. But John Harden kidnaps the woman he loves more than anyone on earth, takes her out of harm's way, and brings her to a make-believe castle in a hideaway that no one else knows about. Mom knows the rest of us love her in theory, but poor, crazed, lunatic John Harden steals away with her in the night and has the whole state on alert looking for her. We hand our love of Mom over to the doctors. John Harden takes her down the Edisto River, cooks her bass that he set a trot line for, builds her fires, and feeds her by hand in a half-abandoned fish camp that you can't reach except by water. Like everything else, love's not worth much without some action to back it up. "We went looking for her. We found her and brought her back," T said. "Thank John Harden for that," I said. "When Mom dies, that's going to leave just Dad," T continued. "Let's go back inside," I suggested to T. "We can be there for her when she needs us." 2 nights later, at 2 in the morning, I was sleeping in a cot at the end of her bed when I heard her cry out and found her covered with vomit. Her hair was falling out in lifeless chunks again, and her breath was ragged and coarse. Her hand squeezed my wrist as I wiped the vomit from her gown and cleaned it off her throat and arms. Even as I cleaned her up, she vomited again and again. I was covered with it when she began whispering that she had to get to the bathroom quickly. "Everything's breaking up. It's coming apart," she whispered desperately as I lifted her off the bed. She felt weightless and tiny, no larger than a loaf of bread. Her legs collapsed when her feet touched the cold linoleum floor, and I lifted her from beneath her armpits and carried her like a rag doll to the bathroom. But as I placed her on the toilet, I saw and smelled the trail of diarrhea left in her path across the hospital room floor. Her inside seemed to fall out as she vomited and sprayed diarrhea everywhere. Tears flooded down her cheeks, and she whimpered in humiliation and pain. "Do the best you can, Mama, and I'll come back for you in a minute," I said, and I shut the bathroom door after clearing the vomit off her once again. I ripped the sheets and blankets off her bed and changed them quickly. With another towel, I cleaned the trail of puddling excrement from the floor and disinfected it with Lysol. I scrubbed the walls clean of vomit, scrubbed myself, and then hurled a bundle of foul laundry out into the hall. Then I knocked softly on the door, got control of the panic and the disgust in my voice, and said, "You okay, Mama? Everything under control?" "Could you please bathe me, son?" she asked. "It'll be a pleasure, Mama." "I stink. I'm a mess." "That's why they invented soap." I got the hot water going and placed Lucy beneath the showerhead. The water healed something inside her, and she moaned with pleasure as I soaped her down from head to foot, not feeling a bit odd that it was my mother's own nakedness I was moving over with my hands. As I washed her hair, small islands of it came out in my hands, and I laid them like linen on a towel rack just outside the shower. When I had dried her off, I put one of her pink turbans over her head and placed a fresh hospital gown on her body. I brushed her teeth gently and let her wash her mouth out with mouthwash again and again till the taste of vomit was gone. I touched her cheeks and throat with drops of White Shoulders perfume, the essence of Lucyhood to me. When I returned her to bed, she was already asleep. There were spots where I had not cleaned up completely, and this time I went over the entire room from top to bottom, and it sparkled when I finished. I arranged the flowers differently, bringing them closer to the bed. I wanted her to awake to the smell of roses and lilies, and I even thought about sprinkling the last clear plastic bag of chemotherapy with her perfume. An hour later, I was content at last that there was no trace of Lucy's violent sickness left in the room, and I lay myself down, exhausted, on the cot. The moonlight on my face surprised me, and out the window the southern stars that were written in the sky like the alphabet above a blackboard confronted me. Their light seemed familiar, comradely. I raised myself up on my elbow and looked out toward the river, which repeated the stars in perfect mimicry, like a piece of backlit sheet music. I longed to be freed from all responsibility, to withdraw from all human connections, to hide out in that run-down cabin down the Edisto that could not be reached by postman or car, to live on what could be found in the forest or grown in the clearings or trapped in the river. Then I thought of Shyla. Her memory sharpened its knives against my heart, and there was only agony in its echo and encore. Without me, Shyla was sea sound and wind song. Staring at those stars, I made a constellation out of Shiloh's pretty face. She haunted me with light. Again and again, I sought the cool side of the pillowcase and tried vainly to find a comfort zone somewhere on that unfamiliar, lumpy cot. I tried to hear Lucy's breathing and could only make out the raw choir of insects calling to each other through the vast fields of grass. Finally, I sat up in the old despair of insomnia and saw the moonlight crossing over my mother's exhausted face. Her eyes were open and she was looking at the night sky, too. "I thought it was over last night," Lucy said, her lips chapped and feverish. "If I'd had a gun, I'd have pulled the trigger myself."
"I'd have been happy to do it for you," I said. "I've never seen anybody so sick."
"I'll be grateful when it's just me and the cancer again," Lucy said. "This other stuff was made in factories. Leukemia might be killing me, but at least it's my own recipe."
"You're going to be just fine, Mama," I said.
"I'm not," Lucy replied. "It's sweet how all my sons pretend I'm going to walk away from this. What's interesting is that I thought I'd be more afraid than I am. Oh, sometimes the fear nearly doubles me up. But mostly, I feel a great sense of relief, of resignation. I feel a part of something vast. I was just looking at the moon. Look at it, Jack. It's almost full tonight, and I've always known what the moon was doing and what phase it was in, even if I wasn't paying attention. When I was a girl, I thought the moon was mountain-born like me. I can barely remember what my mama's face looked like, Jack, but she was a sweet woman born to too much trouble. She once showed me and my brother the full moon. She told us about the man in the moon and how everyone claimed they could see a man's face if they stared hard enough, but she had never seen him. Her mother had told her that there was a lady in the moon that very few people ever got to see. It took patience to see her because she was shy about her beauty. She had a shining crown of hair and a perfect profile. The lady in the moon was seen from the side, and she was as pretty as those women you see in cameos in jewelry shops in Asheville. You can only see her when the moon's coming up to full. She doesn't show herself to everyone, but once you see her, you never even think about the man in the moon again.
"Why didn't you ever tell us that story?" I asked.
"I just remembered it. Memories of my past keep flooding in. I've no control over them. My poor brain seems to be in a hurry to think everything it can before the end," she said. "My mind feels like a museum that takes in every painting it's offered. I can't control the flow."
"Sounds kind of nice," I suggested.
"Help me with something, Jack."
"Be glad to, Mama, if I can."
"Since I've never died before, I don't know how to do it right," Lucy said. "I think I know what to say to Dr. Pitts, because he sees me through such a fog of love that he'll never know who I really am. But it's different with you boys. I put you through tests and made you jump through hoops and made your lives hard when they didn't have to be. I didn't know that my ignorance could hurt my kids like it did. Because I saw such awful things as a kid, I thought all I had to do was keep your bellies filled and enough clothes on your backs so you wouldn't hurt during the winter time. I didn't know the first thing about psychology. Shoot, I was over 40 before I knew the word started with a P. Psychology was the one animal in the forest I'd never heard tell of. I could track a deer or hunt bears with dogs or wait for a mountain lion to come back to its lair. But how do you set a trap for psychology, for something you can't see or know? I raised 5 pretty boys who all seem unhappy to me because something was cracked or missing in our family. Everyone seems mad at me. But my errors were made in the act of trying out the high wire. Every time I tried something, it was the first time I ever did it. I was a girl who had to learn everything on the run. Trial and error was the only school I went to."
"You did great, Mama."
"I want to thank you for something else," she said.
"No need to," I assured her.
"I never thanked you for teaching me how to read," she said.
"I didn't know I did," I answered.
"When you came home from the first grade, you made me listen to everything you learned in school each day. You made me sit down with you while you did your homework. All kids do that, I said. See, Spot, run. Run, Spot, run. Run, she remembered. The plot wasn't very good. I lived in terror that someone would find out, my mother said. You were so patient with me, Jack. I was too embarrassed to even thank you. Pleasure, Mama, just like everything else about you. Then why is everybody so mad? Because we can't bear to think about you dying, I said. Not one of us can process that one piece of information without going absolutely berserk. Can I help you with it, Jack? She asked. Don't do it. Stay here. Get off that train, I said. That train stops for everyone, Lucy said. Jenny Penn's been dying for 20 years, I said. She's still around. Couldn't kill that girl with a stick, Lucy said, smiling. Lord, me and Jenny Penn had some fights that Lee and Grant were glad they missed. Did you and Shyla fight much? I don't think we fought much at all, Mama, I said. We seemed to know what each other was thinking all the time. She seemed just like me in a lot of ways. You think Shyla killed herself because I made her unhappy, Mom?
No, of course I don't. You two were crazy about each other. She was hearing the voices that killed her when she was a little girl. John Harden hears those same voices. There's a kind of songbird, too pretty to fly with the crows and the starlings. The other birds attack it in flocks and tear it apart when it starts to sing. Nothing soft endures. Nature loathes meekness and goodness. Shyla got hurt early and deep. You kept her from the bridge as long as you could, son.
You think she and John Harden are alike?
The same tribe. Both of them so full of love it causes an imbalance. They fall over with the unbearable weight of it. The fall becomes what they do best. They grow accustomed to great odds. Love floods them, overwhelms them, and makes them impossible to be around. They need love in equal proportion to what they throw off. Everyone disappoints them. Eventually they die of the cold. They can never find the right angel.
I'm a cold man, Mama, I said. There's something about me that chills anyone who tries to get close to me. I've known women who almost suffered from frostbite after we've spent a weekend together. I don't want it to be that way. But even when I'm most aware of it, I'm helpless to do anything about it. I've told Leah that I think that love is another thing that has to be taught. I think it can be divided into parts, numbered and named, to make its mastery easier. I don't think I was taught it, Mama. I think it might have bypassed you and Dad. Everyone talks about love all the time. It's like the weather. But how does a man like me learn to do it? How do I unlock those pipes and jets where it lies in the deepest parts of me? If I knew how to do it, Mama, I'd let everybody have their fair share. I'd spread it around and I wouldn't skimp for anyone. But no one taught me the steps to that dance. No one broke it into parts. I think the only way I can love is in secret. There's a deep, sourceless river I can tap into when no one else is near. But because it lies hidden and undiscovered, I can't lead expeditions to it. So I love strangely and obliquely. My love becomes a kind of guesswork. It brings no refreshment nor eases any pain.
Leah, you adore Leah. Everyone knows that, especially the child.
But I'm not sure she feels it. And is my adoration the love that others talk about? The danger will come when she tries to love a man with a love that isn't real. If it isn't, then her children will have to suffer from the same masquerade. But, except with Leah, I don't know how to do it. I don't know what it is, Mama. I don't know what it feels like or looks like or where to find it.
It's something that doesn't take to worry very well. You can't handle it too much. You let love be and it'll find its own way in its own time.
It doesn't work that way for me.
Love any way you can, Jack, Lucy said. I don't think you're very good talking about it. It comes easier to girls. You get tongue-tied and scared every time the subject comes up.
It avoids me, I said. I can never say what I mean about it. I think about love all the time. Why can't there be a definition of it? 9 or 10 words that sum it all up, that could be repeated over and over again until it becomes clear.
You want to teach Leah about it? Lucy whispered. Is that it?
Yes, and I can't. I don't have a clue, I admitted.
You don't need words, son. You've got all the equipment. Tell her love is cleaning vomit off your mother's gown and bed, cleaning diarrhea from a hospital floor, flying 5,000 miles when you hear your mother's sick. Tell her love is finding a very sick brother on the Edisto River and bringing him back without hurting him, bringing a drunk father home 100 times during your teen years. Tell Leah it's raising a little girl alone. Love's action, Jack. It isn't talk, and it never has been. You think these doctors and nurses won't know you love me when they see what you've done tonight? Think I don't know it, Jack?
I like it when I've got procedures to follow, I said, when I'm moving around with something real to do.
You'll have your hands full in the next few weeks, Lucy said. I'm starting to run on empty. Time's short, Jack. The cancer's spread to my organs. It's everywhere now.
Does believing in God help any?
Hell, she said. Believe me when I tell you it's the only thing that helps at all.
Both of us laughed, and I propped Lucy up on pillows so we could watch the dawn break together.
There it is again. Talk about dependable.
Glad to see last night take off, I said.
I'll be going home this weekend, Lucy said. No, no, don't try to talk me out of it. They've done what they can for me here. I'll hire nurses as I need them. I want to die listening to the ocean. I'd also like all my boys around me. All of them.
John Harden'll have to do some fast talking up at the state hospital, I said. He's presently the most famous crazy person in the state.
John Harden isn't crazy, Lucy said,
her head turned toward the light out of the east.
He's just his mama's boy. He thought if he hid me good enough, then death wouldn't know where to find me.
Wish it worked that way, I said.
Lucy said, maybe it does. You boys didn't give it a chance.
So my mother returned to the Isle of Orion to live out the time allotted her. Though we all knew that Lucy was complicated, unknowable, and difficult, none of us knew exactly how courageous a woman she was until she began the business of dying. Daily she gave us lessons in the art of dying well. Her house on the beach filled up with friends who dropped by to make their farewells and discovered, to their surprise, that they had come to a house of great joy. Though she may have had many regrets about her origins, Lucy had discovered most of the secrets that the South sugarcoated its ladies with, and she charmed her visitors with her vivaciousness. Mama had learned that being nice summed up every book of etiquette ever written, or every code of law passed down by word of mouth. On October 10th, the last turtle nest of the season was to be opened, and Lucy demanded to be present. The cool weather had already come to the low country of South Carolina, but the ducks and geese had not yet made their way this far south on the eastern flyway. We still went swimming out in front of her house twice a day, and she liked to sit out on her deck holding Dr. Pitts's hand as I walked out into deep water with Leah standing on my shoulders, or as Dallas swam out past the breakers. Over 100 people had gathered for the release of the turtles when Lucy walked with our help to the wire-protected nest harboring the turtle eggs that had been moved in August. Lucy's volunteers had monitored the emptying of 41 nests on the Isle of Orion that season. 4,633 baby loggerheads had made it into the water. Lucy stood before this final nest and asked Leah, "How many eggs were moved to this spot?" Leah had her notebook and read out, 121 eggs, Grandma."
"Who found the nest?"
"Betty Sobel, Grandma."
"Ah, Betty," Lucy said. "I've asked Betty to take over the program next year. I think it's time someone else took care of these turtles for a while. I'd like to sleep in with that good-looking husband of mine instead of traipsing all over these beaches at sunrise."
There was a brief outburst of applause when the task was passed to Betty Sobel. Then the gravity of Lucy's condition quieted the crowd again.
"Does anyone object if Leah takes the turtles out of this nest? I'd do it myself, but I'm feeling a bit peaked. Can you do it once more, girl?"
"I was born to do it, Grandma," Leah said, and she knelt down in the sand and began digging as 100 people leaned forward to watch. Leah dug down into the caved-in sand, overcautious at first. Then she smiled, looked at her grandmother, and came up with a black, struggling miniature loggerhead. The crowd cheered when Leah handed it to Lucy. Lucy inspected it and put it in the sand-lined bucket. Leah came up with 3 turtles in the next scoop of her hand. Within the nest, the scrimmage of shells clicking made it sound like 100 dice rolling across velvet. When Leah was done, she gathered all the eggshells and began to cover them with sand.
"Save 1 shell for yourself, Leah," Lucy ordered. "Now, you take these turtles down and release them 20 yards from the surf line. We want them to imprint this island's sand."
"Let's release them together, Grandma," Leah said, and she and Lucy began the slow walk down toward the breakers as the crowd parted to let them pass. It took all of Lucy's strength to make that walk, but no one could deter her, so T brought down a lawn chair for her to sit in at the spot where the turtles would begin their long, perilous voyage out into the Atlantic. Their claws scratched against the side of the bucket. Lucy handed Leah the broken golf club, and Leah began to draw a vast semicircle in the sand that the observers could not cross. Inside this line was the free zone of the infant turtles. The people on the beach towed the line with their bare feet and flip-flops, but did not cross it. Setting the bucket on the ground, Lucy nodded to Leah, who turned the bucket gently on its side against the sand, and the baby turtles began their 4-flippered journey across their birthing ground to the sea. They rushed out toward the brightness of the water with all the fury of pure instinct ignited. Though their gait was comical, it was purposeful and resolute. Theirs was an ancient, frantic march. But these turtles would not meet an army of raccoons or an overflight of seagulls or the ominous gathering of ghost crabs positioned like a tank battalion, waiting to cut off their dash to the waves. These turtles were cheered and urged on by those who had come to see them safely launched from the Isle of Orion. The first turtle to reach the wet sand was 5 yards ahead of any of his competitors when the wave hit him and sent him somersaulting backward, as it always did. But the small loggerhead recovered quickly, righted itself, and was a swimmer by the time the next wave hit. Each turtle tumbled when the first surf rushed over it, but each swam with great economy and beauty on the second wave. A single ghost crab moved out of its hole and seized one of the turtles by its neck and moved in a flash to its lair beneath the sand. I noticed that Lucy, too, saw this encounter between hunter and prey, but she said not a word. The ghost crab was being true to its own nature and felt no animosity toward the turtle at all. Soon the first waves were brimming with the shining backs of turtles, glinting like ebony among the snow-white spume. One turtle, confused, got turned around and started back toward the nest, but Leah took it and turned it in the right direction. She looked at her grandmother for approval, and Lucy nodded her appreciation of a job well done. When all the turtles had reached the water, we tried to follow their trail by watching their tiny, eel-like heads come up for breath every 6 or 7 strokes. A seagull, scanning the beach as it retired from the day's foraging, came up from the south, and the crowd moaned as it hung still as laundry over the surf line, then plunged down and came up with a loggerhead in its beak. The gull bit the head off the turtle, then dropped the rest of its body back into the ocean.
"I hate seagulls," Leah said.
"No, you don't. They do a good job at what they do," Lucy said.
"You just love loggerheads."
In the week that followed, I cooked fabulous meals for anyone who came to the house to say goodbye to my mother. Hundreds came, and it moved us greatly that Lucy's life had not gone unnoticed by her townsmen. As her children, we knew all about Lucy's strangeness and insecurity, but we also knew about the unstinting nature of her sweetness. She had camouflaged the vinegar factory in her character with a great honeycomb along the sills and porches of her public self. The black leaders came, dressed in strict formality, to let her know that they remembered the extraordinary courage of the wife of the nigger judge. I learned that week that my mother possessed a small genius for the right gesture. She had done thousands of things she did not have to do, only because they felt comfortable to her. She had been prodigal with unnoticed, artless moments of making people happy to be alive. Lucy could not eat a single thing that I cooked for her, yet she bragged that her friends had claimed they had never eaten so well, not even when they went to watch the Braves play in Atlanta. No one entered the house whom I did not feed, and I stayed at my command post in the kitchen because I was having difficulty controlling my helplessness. I could not get over the fact that I was facing a motherless world for the first time, and it made me look at Leah with new eyes as she played hostess, greeting people at the door and asking them to sign the guest book. Leah had informed me that school was not as important as helping her grandmother die, and I wondered that such wisdom had issued forth in a girl so young. One day, very late, Dr. Pitts picked up the telephone in the living room and dialed a number with all the rest of us present. We heard him say, "Hello, Judge," and I listened as he invited my father to come out. Still uncomfortable around the boisterousness of my brothers and me, Dr. Pitts had made certain that we understood that he needed our help in the days to come. Those days came swiftly. I found that, though I had prepared myself for my mother's death, I had not readied myself for the details and what death would require of me. I watched the slow process of my mother becoming a complete stranger, a woman devoid of energy and animation who never left her bed, a hostess who could not rise to meet her guests. Her eyes grew dull with painkillers, and she would ask Leah to lie down with her for a nap, then be asleep before Leah could even respond. Her bloodstream ripened its betrayal of her and grew dangerous as pitchblende to her health. Her decline steepened its angle hourly. What had been a slow, invisible process for so long began to show itself on the surface and accelerate the pace. Then the terrible galloping began. There was the occasional evening when she seemed better, but they were rare. We swarmed about her, desperate for a task to perform, a heroic deed to pull off in exchange for Lucy's life. Our source was flickering out. We had grown out of this departing body. We were natives of the body now killing her. We poured each other drinks, clung to each other, and burst into tears while walking on the beach at night when the claustrophobia of death became too much for us. I thought my mother needed the ministrations and the laying on of hands that a daughter could do so much better than her roughhousing, excitable sons, who waited around wishing Lucy would ask us to move a refrigerator or paint the garage. As a group, we were useless, disquieted, and in the way. The nurses were interchangeable, sweet, and efficient. We wanted to hold her in our collective arms, pass her around from sun to sun, but we were shy about touch, deficient in all displays of physical affection, and afraid we would break something as the withering began its work and her skin took on the pallor of writing paper. Lucy seemed to rally one day, and the spirits of the entire house rose with her, like some flood tide cleansing the marshes after a hard winter. That morning, when I brought in the breakfast that I knew she would not touch, I found Lucy sitting up with Leah, teaching her how to apply makeup. Leah had apparently made a mess of putting lipstick on her own and Lucy's lips, but she was doing much better the second time around. I laid the tray down and watched as my mother passed on the mysterious rites of cosmetics to my daughter. "Close your eye when you put the eyeshadow on, then open it ever so slightly. You want the eyeshadow to coat both lids evenly." "That's right, that's good. Now, let's go on to perfume. Remember, less is more when it comes to perfume. The reason a skunk's a skunk is he doesn't understand moderation. I'm leaving you all my makeup and perfume. I want you to think about me when you use it. Let's redo your foundation. What do you say?"
"Sure," Leah said. "But do you feel up to it?"
"Leah's too young to wear makeup," I said, aware of my echo in Lucy's criticism in Rome and how prissy and parental I sounded.
"Maybe," Lucy agreed, "but not too young to learn how to put it on. Besides, I'm not going to be around to teach her the tricks of the trade. I'm ignorant about a lot of things, but I'm Leonardo da Vinci when it comes to makeup. Leah, this is part of my legacy to you. You're collecting your inheritance, honey."
Later in the morning, I found Leah reading a children's book to Lucy in her clear, musical voice. I could hear Italy sneaking into Leah's pronunciation of English, and it always pleased me. I sat down listening to Leah read Charlotte's Web aloud. I had read the book so many times to her that I could almost speak along with her, word for pretty word. Lucy smiled at me and said,
"No one ever told me these stories when I was little. What a nice way to go to sleep.
Why didn't your parents read to you, Grandma? Leah asked.
Well, they couldn't read, darling, she said. Neither could I until your daddy taught me. He ever tell you that?
It was our secret, Mama, I said.
But ain't it a sweet thing for Leah to know about her daddy? He wasn't just my boy, he was my teacher, too,
Lucy said, and fell into a deep sleep. Father Jude arrived from the monastery that night, and Dupree picked up John Harden at the state hospital. Esther and the great Jew were coming out of the bedroom with Silas and Jenny Penn, when John Harden entered the house, where the fresh flowers were beginning to die in the vases, and a low tide made the sea riper and more aromatic as a wind blew in from the east. Ladere was fixing drinks for the adults, and I was fixing enough pasta carbonara to feed a rugby team. In a guest bedroom, Jude went to prepare himself for the administration of the last rites. For a solid week, he had prayed and fasted for his sister. His faith was unshakable, and he believed that any of Lucy's sins were lightweight to the God who had wept his way through this unendurable century. The entire monastery had stockpiled prayers for Lucy. She would enter paradise buoyed up on a field of praise, well recommended and extremely well regarded by a small platoon of holy men in the service of the Lord. That night, Father Jude said Mass, and Lucy asked that he say it in Latin and that Dupree and I serve as altar boys. The French windows were thrown wide open, and the sea air entered the room like an extra communicant. Lucy asked her brother to add a prayer for all her loggerheads, now swimming toward the kelp-draped sluices of the Sargasso Sea. After she received communion, we bowed our heads. Then each of us, her sons, took the hosts on our tongues, and I prayed for her with all the fierceness that had come to me in this moment. Tears got in the way of my prayers. Now my prayers did not float like wood smoke toward the heights of the world, but were set adrift, stained and waterlogged with tears. The air tasted like salt, and so did the faces of friends and relatives when they kissed me. Late that night, Lucy called for just me and my brothers to come to her alone. We went reluctantly, as though the colonel in charge of a firing squad had just sent for us. The summons had come at last, the inexorable violation. It seemed as though these last days were the only moments I had ever lived life to its fullest, when we gathered in agony to say goodbye to our mother. But T hesitated on the threshold of her room and would not move.
I can't do it, T said tearfully. I don't have it in me.
When he finished weeping, he got control of himself and followed us into the room. By this time, we too were exhausted and knew that dying was a full-time job, more hard labor than some palmy, soft surrender to the night. It took enormous concentration for us to look toward our mother. Lesions had formed on her gums and lips as her body no longer fought infections. She had given death all it could handle, but her hard, unyielding body had now been tested to its limits. Her rosy complexion had yellowed, and something dark was moving close to her eyes. Her stillness began its silent walk as we waited for her to speak. Dallas handed her a glass of water, and she grimaced in pain as she drank. The water glass was stained with blood when he set the glass down. As she tried to speak, John Harden, fidgety in the solemn atmosphere, started.
"Mama, you won't believe what just happened. The doctor came in and said, 'Lucy's going to be your old self by tomorrow morning.' The doc was laughing and said he'd just run a few more tests and found out it wasn't leukemia after all. Hell, he screwed up the original diagnosis. It's just a head cold, or psoriasis at the very worst. Said you'll be playing 36 holes of golf a day by next week. So come on, you guys, put smiles back on your faces."
Dupree shrugged and said, "I made a bad mistake springing him on a pass."
"Hush," Lucy whispered. "I got something to say to you."
We grew still as the ocean spoke to the night, a single wave at a time.
"I did the best I could for you boys," she said. "I wish I had done better by you. You should have been born in the house of a queen."
"We were," Dupree said in a barely audible voice. "Damn right we were," said Dallas.
"Shh,"
Lucy said, and we had to lean forward to hear her.
"I should have loved you more and needed you less. You were the only things I ever got for free." "Mama, Mama, Mama," John Harden said, sinking on his knees beside her and sobbing. Lucy lapsed into her final coma, hearing the first words that all of us spoke in the English language. Into that night, my mother slipped away from me. It took Lucy 40 hours to die, and we hardly left her side. Doctors and nurses came and went, checking her vital signs and making her comfortable. Her breathing became an agonized, desperate noise. It was a ragged and hydraulic sound, and for me, it became the only sound on earth. We spent those last hours kissing her frequently and telling her how deeply we loved her. Then I began to read Leah's children's books out loud to her. She had lived a storyless childhood, so I read in the last day of her life the books she had missed. I told her about Winnie the Pooh and Yertle the Turtle, took her Where the Wild Things Are, introduced her to Peter Rabbit and Alice in Wonderland. Each of us took turns reading to her out of Grimm's fairy tales, and, at the very last, Leah insisted that I tell all the great dog Chippy stories I had told her during our years of exile from the family in Rome. I told Leah's favorite great dog Chippy stories to my brother's amusement, but then I saw the moment they got hooked by the power of the stories themselves. I watched as Leah took turns sitting in my brother's laps, and I thought how wonderful it must be to have an excess of adoring uncles to choose from. Then, an hour before Lucy died, I told one last story of that splendid dog who had died before John Harden or T ever got to know her well. In a pretty house on a pretty island in the pretty state of South Carolina, a woman named Lucy was getting ready to make her last journey. She had already said her goodbyes and gotten her affairs straight. She had kissed her granddaughter Leah farewell and had taught her how to do her nails and apply makeup to her face. Her sons had gathered around her, and she made them all feel good by choosing the right words to make them remember her fondly forever. Even though her favorite son by far was Jack, she was equally nice to all of them at this moment of departure. Even John Harden laughed good-naturedly at this aside. It took her a long time to die because she loved the earth and her town and her family so much. But when she left, she was amazed to lift out of her body and rise above the house and the ocean. She looked down on the moon and the stars and the Milky Way, free of her body, and she felt winged and floating and beautiful as she spun around in the sweet light of stars she passed. Then she came to the place she had heard about. It was in a field of wildflowers, surrounded by mountains, prettier than the Blue Ridge, higher than the Alps. Lucy had never felt as at home before. This was the place, she knew that, but did not know it by name. Lucy heard a voice thunder out above her. She knew it was the voice of God. It was stern but lovely. She awaited his judgment with confidence, with ardor. Her granddaughter Leah had applied her makeup for this long trip home, and Lucy knew she was going to look pretty to the God who had created her. But another voice sounded behind her, and it terrified her. Lucy turned to see Satan and his armies of demons crossing the field to claim her as their own. Satan was puce-colored and hideous, and he danced up behind Lucy where she could feel his hot breath on her neck. Satan roared, "She is mine. I claim her for the underneath. She has earned her portion of fire honestly. You have no business with this one, and I claim for hell what is mine." "Slowly, Satan," the voice of the Lord rang out. "This is Lucy McCall from Waterford. You have no claim on this woman at all. Though you want every soul that comes this way, you did not earn this one." "I claim her anyway, Lord. She has suffered much on earth, and she's well accustomed to pain. Pain is what she knows best. Without suffering, she would never feel at home." Though Lucy struggled mightily, she felt Satan's hand tighten around her throat, and when she tried to speak, she could not form the words, and found herself being dragged out of the field so fragrant with wildflowers. Lucy thought she was doomed to hell for all eternity when she heard something. "I know what she heard," Leah squealed.
"What's that?" her uncles asked.
"She heard grr, grr."
"Where was that sound coming from?" Dallas asked.
"It's the great dog Chippy," Leah said, "just in the nick of time. She'll save the day, even if God can't, right, Daddy?"
The fangs of the great dog Chippy were white and wolf-like. Her lips were curled, and her black, muscled body looked like a panther's walking toward Satan. The other demons shrank back in terror, but not Satan. But Chippy had never approached an enemy with such ferocity. Her eyes were yellow, and she moved in for the kill. She crouched, ready to spring at the source of all evil. The dog had come to greet the woman, who had found her as a stray, taken her into a house full of children, fed her, stroked her fur, loved her as a dog needed to be loved. "Ha!" Satan cried out. "You think I should fear a dog?" He was addressing God himself, still holding Lucy. "No, you need not fear a dog," God answered, "except for this one." "Why this one? Why this cur?" "Because I sent the dog. The dog does my will," God answered. And the Prince of Darkness released Lucy and returned to his house of fire. Lucy went to her knees and kissed the great dog Chippy, and accepted her kisses in return. Then the dog led the way through flowers toward the light. That night, Lucy died with my brothers and me around her. When the undertaker came to take her body the next morning, her nightgown was still wet from the tears of her 5 sons, 2 husbands, 1 brother, and her granddaughter, Leah McCall. The world seemed to stop when she stopped breathing, but a high tide was on the way into the rivers and sounds, and the sun lit a fire on the horizon, the first sunrise Lucy had ever missed since she had slept in her seaside house. At her funeral mass, one could hear an entire town mourning. Her 5 sons and her ex-husband, the judge, served as her pallbearers, and they carried the beautiful, polished coffin her son John Harden had made for her to the front of the church. It was a gray, overcast day, and Dr. Pitts wept during the whole service, as did Dallas, Dupree, T., John Harden, my father, and I. There was not a stiff upper lip among us. Lucy's love had indentured and leveled us. Her tenderness leaked out of us. She left us hurt and powerless on our knees. At the cemetery, my brothers and I buried her, taking our time speaking with her as though she could hear us. I had lost the word mother forever, and I could not bear it. After listening to the condolences of the town, which had gathered at the house on the Isle of Orion, tired of mourning and depleted from the effort of smiling, I put on my bathing suit and, with Leah, went out for a long swim in the ocean. The water felt warm and silken, and Leah's hair glistened like a seal's as she dove off my shoulders and rode the huge, breaking waves all the way to shore. I said little but took comfort and undiminishable pleasure in the physicality of swimming, the pull of the tide, the swell and rocking of the ocean itself. Leah had learned to swim like an otter, throw a shrimp net as well as I could, and could already slalom behind a ski boat. She was becoming a low country girl, and I held her close to me as we rested in the surf 20 yards from shore. "Look, Daddy," Leah said. "Ladere's calling us in." On the shore, still dressed from the funeral, but barefoot now, with her black dress and pearls, Ladere waved to us, and we both swam toward her. When we reached the shore, Ladere held something in her hand. "Betty Sobel just brought this by. Someone found it wandering on the golf course. She thinks it's been lost for days." Ladere opened her hand, and in it was a tiny loggerhead turtle, but pure white, the first albino I had ever seen. It was motionless, and Ladere said, "Betty thinks it might be dead. She was wondering if you and Leah would take it out to deep water. If it's alive, she doesn't think it could survive this surf." I took the turtle in my hand and held it like a pocket watch in my palm. "No sign of life," I said. "Let's put him in the water, Daddy," said Leah. "We'll go as deep as we can." I put Leah on my shoulders, and I began walking toward the strong waves, bracing myself as they broke across my chest. I handed the turtle up to Leah and told her to keep it high above her head, away from the waves. "Even if it's not alive, Leah, it can become part of the food chain," I said.
"Great, Daddy, being part of the food chain."
The walk against the tide was a struggle, but when we were beyond the breakers, Leah handed the lifeless turtle to me. I checked it a last time, then took it and plunged it into the rich, warm Atlantic waters. After a few moments, I felt the loggerhead stir once. Then I felt the ignition as the turtle moved all 4 flippers, and the life force of instinct burned through every cell in its body. "It's alive!" I cried out to Leah, and I released the turtle at the surface. Both Leah and I then swam beside it as the albino got its bearings, drew in a breath, and disappeared from sight. Dog paddling, we saw the tiny white head come up 6 feet away from us, then plunge again. We followed the turtle until we reached water over my head. Then we swam back to shore, where Ladere was waiting for us.
Epilogue. The following summer, Ladere Ansley and I got married in the city of Rome and invited everyone we loved to the wedding. When we wrote the movie that Mike Hess had hired us to write, we discovered that we could not live without each other. When I finally got around to asking her to marry me, I found out that Ladere and Leah had recently picked out her wedding dress in Charleston. She had already made up a guest list and written out the announcement for the newspaper. The only person surprised by my falling in love with Ladere was me. But I had lived a long time knowing of the hardships and perils that eat around the edges of even the strongest loves. I wanted to be absolutely sure. I popped the question to her at a party we gave for Jordan Elliott the day before he began serving his prison sentence at Fort Leavenworth. He had received a 5-year prison term for manslaughter and malicious destruction of federal property. The lead prosecutor wanted to put Jordan behind bars for 20 years for murder, but Capers Middleton worked out a deal after convincing the federal authorities that a whole monastery would testify to Jordan's saintly attributes if the case ever came to trial. General Rembert Elliott moved to Kansas to be with his son for the entire period of his incarceration. Throughout the pre-trial maneuverings, the general was fiercely protective of his son at every step. Each day, General Elliott visited Jordan in prison, and a deep affection grew between them. To their surprise and delight, they discovered how deeply a friendship between a father and son could cut through all the hurt and refuse of a troubled past. In the ruins of their lives, they had found each other, and clung to each other, and become reconciled even to their amazing differences. On the night before the wedding, Ladere and I walked up to the Janiculum, with the ancient, misted city spread beneath us in a secret hive of final, rushing motion before the sun's last light splashed along the fringes of the western hills. The last party we would ever attend without being man and wife was in preparation down there, amid the pale lights that came on one by one in the many neighborhoods. I had decided that the Janiculum was the right place to give Shiloh's letter to Ladere. The letter explained some things in a clear, exact way that I knew I could never manage to express. In a courtroom long ago, it had won me the right to raise Leah after the Foxes had sued me for custody of their grandchild. It had touched me deeply, blindingly. It had let me know that I had once known a passion that very few men or women would ever know or feel or even long for in their entire lives. It was the reason I could let Shiloh go, but never tell her goodbye. Now, on the night before my wedding to Ladere, I needed to break off and to let the love of Ladere perform its gentle work on my damaged southern heart. "So, here it is," Ladere said as I handed it to her. "The famous letter." "It deserves to be famous," I said. "You will see." "Who's read it?" she asked. "The courts of South Carolina and now you," I said. "I won't give it to Leah soon. She's been through enough for a while." "I'm already jealous enough of you and Shiloh, of all that I think you had together," Ladere said. "Will this make it worse?" "It'll explain it. Part of it's written about you."
"About me?"
"You'll see." Ladere took the letter out of the envelope carefully. It had been written quickly, and it took her a while to grow accustomed to the idiosyncrasies of Shiloh's troubled, hurried hand. "Dear Jack, it shouldn't end this way, but it must, my love. I swear to you it must. Remember the night we first fell in love, the night the house fell into the sea and we learned we couldn't keep our hands off each other? We couldn't imagine then loving anyone else because of the fire we started that night. And remember the night we conceived Leah in the bed on the top floor of the Hotel Raphael in Rome? That was the best for me because we both wanted a child. The best because we were turning all the craziness and desperation of our lives into something that indicated hope between us.
When you and I were right, Jack, we could set the whole world on fire with our bodies and make the world perfect. I didn't tell you why I left you and Leah, Jack, but I'm telling you now. It's crazy again, and this time it's too much. The lady came back. The lady of the coins came back, the woman I told you about when we were kids. She only came to stare at me and have pity on me when I was a child, but this time she came back cruel. This time she talked in the voices of Germans and spat at me for being a Jew. As a girl, Jack, I couldn't bear what my parents had suffered. Their pain touched me as nothing else ever has. I woke up every morning to their unspoken grief, their war with the world that no words could ever explain. I carried their pain inside me like a child. I sucked on it, fed off it, let it ride in my blood in shards and crystals. Never have I been strong enough to measure up to my parents' terrible history. What they endured tortures me, moves me, makes me wild with helplessness. The Lady of the Coins is calling for me now, Jack, and I can't resist her voice. I have no coins sewn into the buttons of my dress to buy my way out or pay anyone off. The camps call me, Jack. My tattoo is fresh, and the long ride in the cattle cars is over. I dream of Zyklon B. I have to follow the voice, and when I leap off the bridge, Jack, I'm simply going to the pits of the starved and broken bodies of 6 million Jews and throwing myself among them because I can't stop their haunting of me. My mother's and father's bodies lie among these slaughtered Jews, and they weren't ever lucky enough to get to die. In these pits, where I've always dreamed I belonged, I'll take my rightful place. I'll be the Jew who pulls the gold teeth from the dead, the Jew who offers her emaciated body for the making of soap to wash the bodies of the soldiers of the Reich as they battle on the Russian front. It is madness, Jack, but it is real. It's always been the truest thing about me, and I beg your forgiveness. But Jack, dear Jack, good Jack, how can I leave you and Leah? How do I tell the Lady of the Coins about my love for you both? But it's not my love she's after, it's my life. Her voice is so seductive in its brutal sweetness, and she knows her business well. She knows I can't love anyone when my country is the country of the altered, the obsessed, the weeping and the broken. It's for the best, Jack, the best for me. After I'm gone, please tell Leah about me. Tell her all the good parts. Raise her well. Love her for the both of us. Cherish her as I would have. Find the mother in you, Jack. She's there, and she's a good mother, and I'm dependent on you to find and honor her and raise Leah with that sweetest, softest part of you. Do the job I was supposed to, Jack, and don't let anyone stop you. Honor me and remember me by the adoration of our child. And Jack, dear Jack, you'll meet another woman some day. Already I love this woman and cherish her and respect her and envy her. She's got my sweet man, and I'd have fought any woman in the world if she'd tried to take you away from me. Tell her that, and tell her about me. But tell her this, and I'm telling you this, Jack, and I want you to listen to it. I'm waiting for you, Jack. I'm waiting in that house that the sea took the first night we loved each other, when we knew that our destinies had touched. Love her well and be faithful to her, but tell her I'm getting that house ready for your arrival. I'm waiting for you there now, Jack, while you're reading this letter. It's beneath the sea, and angels float in its corners and peek out behind the cupboards. I'll listen for your knock, and I'll open the door, and I'll drag you up to that room where we danced to beach music and kissed while lying on the carpet, and I dared you to fall in love with me. Marry a nice woman, Jack, but not one so nice that you won't want to get back to me in our house beneath the sea. I hope she's pretty, and I hope she'll love our daughter as much as I would have. But tell her I won't give you up completely, Jack. I'll let her borrow you for a little while. I go now, but I'll be waiting for you, darling, in that house pulled into the sea. I command you, Jack, as the last cry of my soul and my undying love for you, marry a fabulous woman. But tell her that I'm the one who brought you to the dance. Tell her that you have to save the last dance for me. Oh, darling, Shiloh. Ladere read the letter 3 times before she folded it carefully and handed it back to me. For several moments she did not speak, trying to hold back her tears.
"I can't love you the way Charlotte did, Jack," she said at last. "I'm not built that way."
"It was a mistake to show you the letter," I said.
"No, it wasn't,"
she said, taking my hand in hers and kissing it.
"It's a beautiful letter and a heartbreaking one. As your bride-to-be, I find it a bit intimidating. I find it unanswerable."
"So do I," I said. "In some ways, I've been a prisoner to that letter. I used to cry every time I read it. I quit crying a couple of years ago."
"Let's go down the hill and have a hell of a life, Jack," Ladere said. "Let's love each other as well as we can. But Charlotte can have the last dance. She earned it."
Jordan had sent a long letter from his prison cell in Leavenworth, blessing our marriage and promising to say a mass for us that same day in the States. He had learned that cells held no fear for him, and that the discipline of prisons seemed almost lax to him after following the strictures of the Trappist rule for so long. He had written to me about the prison ministry the authorities allowed him to run, and the courses in both theology and philosophy he taught to the inmates. He said it made him ache for humanity to see so many men in such great and ceaseless pain, and it alarmed him that so few of them knew how to pray for relief of their suffering. It was not that the other prisoners were godless men that disturbed Jordan, but the fact that their belief in God gave them so little comfort. They talked to him about the stultifying emptiness of their American lives. Their spirits were bereft and undeveloped. Dreamlessness made their eyes vacant and trapped. Jordan had never met so many men in desperate need of spiritual advice. In one letter he had written that he was very happy. His time in prison had reintroduced him to the world and had made his commitment to the priesthood all the stronger. It had ratified and enhanced his vocation. He had turned Leavenworth into a wing of his monastery, and he infused many of his fellow prisoners with the strange, luminant beauty of a Trappist's willful solitude. Jordan wrote that he prayed often and did his best to atone for the crime he committed while being a hot-blooded young man, when he, along with his country, split apart along some central seam. Daily he prayed for the repose of the souls of the young man and woman he had killed by accident, but killed nonetheless. He also sent his love and blessings and asked that he be allowed to marry us again when he got out of prison. I wired him that same day that Ladere and I would not really consider ourselves married until he personally blessed our union. The next day, on the morning of the wedding, Leah and I left the Piazza Farnese for a walk through the brown, dazzling alleyways of the city where she had lived most of her childhood. I wanted one last morning with my daughter alone, and Ladere had understood perfectly. When it was right, I thought as I walked hand in hand with Leah, the love between us contained elements of tenderness and reliance and secret conveyance that made it different from all other forms of love. Since hearing the stories of George and Ruth Fox, I often found myself looking at Leah and trying to imagine her being loaded onto a cattle car, or her head being shaved before she stumbled toward the gas chambers, or her small hands raised up in terror as she was being force-marched through a village to a freshly dug pit where the machine gunners awaited her. I drank in the beauty of my daughter and knew I would kill every German in the world before I would let them hurt my child. I could not bear the thought that the world had once been demonic enough to hunt down and exterminate children as though they were insects or vermin. Leah McCall, daughter of a Jewish woman, would have been black ash hanging over the mountains of Poland had she been born 50 years before this day, I thought, tightening my grip. But on this morning I told Leah the story of Ruth Fox and her harrowing survival during World War II. I described the murder of Ruth's family, her escape into the world of the Catholic resistance, and her hiding in a convent until the great Jew miraculously ransomed her out of wartime Poland and brought her to Waterford, South Carolina. For the first time, I told Leah about the dress her great-grandmother had sewn for her daughter Ruth, and how that long-dead woman had hidden 8 cloth-covered gold coins as buttons, which Ruth was to use to buy her way out of trouble. As we drifted past the dark shops, I felt the power of the story grab me again, As I told Leah how Ruth had concealed the coin-laden dress behind an altar where the Virgin Mary stood crowned as the Queen of the Angels, and how her grandmother Ruth had prayed to this woman that she knew had been born a Jew in Palestine 2,000 years ago. I told her that Ruth had believed her whole life that Mary had heard and answered the prayers of one Jewish girl who asked for her intercession in a church in war-torn Poland. Ruth had called the statue the Lady of Coins, and it was a story that had marked Leah's mother, Shiloh, deeply and for all time. On Ponte Mazzini, overlooking the Tiber, I presented Leah with the coin necklace that Shiloh had worn every day of her life, except her last one. In her will, Shiloh specified that the necklace be given to Leah when she was old enough to hear the story. She trusted me to make the decision when that would be. When the war was over, Ruth had 3 coins left in her dress. She had necklaces made with each one of them. She wears one of them. Aunt Martha has another. This was your mother's necklace, Leah. It was her most beloved possession. I'd like you to remember her every time you wear it, and remember your grandmother's story. Leah put on Shiloh's necklace, and her neck and shoulders were as lovely as her mother's. I was starting to notice the first shy ripening toward womanhood, and it both touched and frightened me. I prayed that Leah would have the good fortune to fall in love with a man completely different from myself, a man less tortured and with a smaller stable of demons, one who loved laughter and language and possessed a small genius for sunniness and joy.
"I'll wear it every day of my life, Daddy," Leah said.
"Your mama'd love that," I said. "We better be getting back, kid. You've got to help me get married today."
Leah said, "I can't wait. It's about time you got me a mother, don't you agree?"
"Yeah," I said, "I agree. By the way, Leah, thanks for being the kid you are. You are the sweetest, nicest, most adorable child I've ever seen in my life, and you were that way from the day we brought you home from the hospital to right now. I didn't do a goddamn thing except watch you in utter admiration and fascination."
"Take a little bit of credit, Daddy," Leah said, studying the gold coin on the end of her necklace before looking back at me. "I didn't grow up by myself. You raised me."
"It was a pleasure, kid," I said.
Late that afternoon, our wedding party gathered on the Capitoline Hill in a piazza designed by Michelangelo. Storm clouds were gathering, and a light breeze from the Apennines suddenly turned gusty, and sheets of newspaper winged across the paving stones. The bands of over 50 couples were posted in the glass-encased bulletin boards that lined the outer wall of an ancient building that was part art museum and part wedding chapel. It was to this spot that Romans came to have their marriages legalized by the city of Rome. The bands were written down in an old-world, showy penmanship. All around us, in distinct and separate groups, lovely Roman brides with their dark, nervous fiancés stood uncomfortably among their jubilant families, waiting for their names to be called in the overcast piazza. Looking around, I thought the human species was in fine shape, and tried to think of something more beautiful than women, and couldn't come up with a thing. The propagation of the species was a dance of total joy. When our names were finally called, a loud cheer went up from our friends and relatives who had come to Rome for the ceremony. A large, rowdy contingent from Waterford had arrived the week before the wedding, and it reminded me that there was no wilder crowd on earth than a group of traveling Southerners. They whooped and hollered as they made their way into the grand hall, which smelled of leather and old velvet, and whose high-ceilinged stateliness silenced everyone as we moved toward the solemn men, elegant and impressive as llamas, who would conduct and record the ceremony forever in the annals of Rome. The South Carolinians gathered on the left side of the aisle, and my Roman friends took their seats on the right. Leah's teacher, Sua Rosaria, was there, sitting beside Paris and Linda Shaw, and she blew me a kiss. I bowed to the Roscovic brothers and waved to the waiter, Freddy, who had deserted Da Fortunato at noon to be at our ceremony. Several of the doctors who had cared for me after the airport massacre were there. Marcella Hazan and her husband had come down from Venice, and Giuliano Bugialli drove down after his cooking class in Florence had finished for the week. Journalists and great cooks had come together to celebrate the marriage of one of their own. I took a quick, silent survey and figured that at least 30 cookbooks could be accounted for on this side of the chapel. If a bomb exploded during the wedding, I thought, the eating habits of half the world would change. Ladere blew kisses to our smaller South Carolinian contingent. My brothers and their families had arrived 2 weeks early and had traveled all over Italy in a whirlwind tour I had arranged. Ladere's mother brought smiles to the Roman side when she waved one finger at them and drawled, "Ciao, y'all!" She and her husband had brought Ladere and Capers' children with them. The great Jew was there with his wife Esther, accompanied by Silas and Jenny Penn, who had made a full and unexpected recovery from her broken hip. In Rome, she remained peevish because she thought the Italians spoke a foreign language, just to be peculiar and irritate her. Dr. Pitts sat in the back with Celestin Elliott, who still had not spoken to her husband after his part in putting Jordan in jail. Three of Ladere's suite mates from the university were there with their husbands. Mike arrived late, bringing with him the achingly beautiful actress Sandra Scott, who would later become his fifth wife. Shiloh's sister Martha sat in the front row with her fiancé from Atlanta. My father was not present and had sent a brief note explaining that I'm still drunk and probably always will be. I can't make it, Jack and Ladere, and there's no excuse for it. I just can't. My wedding present to you is that I won't embarrass either of you at your wedding. It's the best I can do. The magistrate performing the ceremony cleared his throat and motioned that the ceremony was about to begin. Leah moved up beside us, holding a bouquet of flowers and wearing a white silk dress that made her long, dark hair look like black flame against her shoulders. On her bare throat, she wore Shala's necklace, and the profile of Tsar Nicholas was as sharp as the outline of Leah's collarbones. I bent down to kiss her and was surprised when I felt tears on her face. "Why are you crying?"
"Because I'm happy, silly," Leah said.
Ladere and I took our places in two gilded, elaborately carved chairs. Beside us sat the best man and the matron of honor, the choice of whom had become the subject of some controversy. We had chosen George and Ruth Fox, and when both families had begun to object, we told them that the decision was not discussable. It had been Ladere's idea, and tears came to my eyes when she told me. Ladere had a lifelong instinct for the proper gesture and the moment of grace, and she recognized in both our lives the terrible, ineffable need for reconciliation and healing. I had told Ladere what the Foxes had endured during the war, and how it had pained me that I had learned it so late. By asking Shala's mother to be her matron of honor, Ladere thought she was making a statement of pure love to Leah. My asking George Fox to be my best man would hopefully heal some of the old wounds and scars between us. It would also bring the spirit of Shiloh into the proceedings and remind everyone of how much history and heartbreak had led to this wonderful moment when Ladere and I would pledge ourselves to each other for the rest of our lives. Then Ladere and I stood and looked at each other, and both liked what we saw. When the magistrate pronounced us man and wife, our friends and families rose and gave us a standing ovation as I kissed Ladere. We all returned to the Piazza Farnese and had the wedding reception on the terraces of my apartment, my brothers having brought tapes full of Carolina beach music. The South Carolinians taught the Romans how to shag that night, and the party did not break up until 2 a.m. In an amazing show of graceful diplomacy, Dallas, Dupree, and T knew better than to play Save the Last Dance for me. But they would tell everyone in South Carolina from that day forward that they had introduced beach music to Italy. I was serving cognac to the last guests when Ladere came over to tell me that she was going with her two children to take her parents back to the Hassler Hotel. I told her to let me come with her, but she pointed to all the people still lingering in the living room and said that she wanted to tuck her parents into bed. Both had drunk too much Italian wine, and my brother Dupree had offered to drive, and John Harden wanted to go along for the ride. "But it's our wedding night," I said, and she stood on tiptoes to kiss me. "I'll wake you up," she promised. "I won't be asleep," I said. "I want to see the sunrise." She smiled. "You made a good decision." "Never made a better one." "I'll hold you to that," she said. "That's why I gave you that ring," I said, pointing to her gold band. "And that's why I accepted it." When the party was finally over, I went up to the terrace again and looked out on the tawny, many-alleyed city. At night, it looked carved from brown sugar. The two fountains spoke to each other in the pretty speech of fallen water on the piazza below. I wanted to thank the city of Rome for healing me and treating me with kid gloves when I was broken on the inside. Rome had taught me that beauty alone was sometimes enough. It had sheltered and nursed me and put me back on course. I tried to find the words to thank a whole city, and I looked out into the rooftops at the bright lights burning on the street along the Tiber, and told myself I would one day write a love letter to Rome that would contain all the praise and thanks I could summon for my time here. There was a noise behind me, and I turned to see Leah coming up to be with me. "I thought you had gone to bed," I said. "I was too excited to sleep," she said as she took my hand. We looked out onto the piazza together, my daughter and I, who had made our life here for so long, looking down onto this spacious and comely piazza. I owed so much to this child and this city, and I realized that words were sometimes nothing more than notes you wrote to your deepest self, as you fought to articulate the splendor and the magic and the ineluctable sense of loss that you felt in the swift, disturbing hours. "It's been you and me alone for a long time, Leah," I said, as a single car passed below us in the night. "Too long, Daddy," she said. "We've been like the Lone Ranger and Tonto," I said. "Better than that," she said. "I think so, too." "Daddy?"
"Yeah, kid?"
"I couldn't help thinking about Mama," she said. "I felt bad because I was really happy for you and Ladere."
"But don't feel bad," I said. "I've thought about her all day, too."
"Why?"
"Because I wanted to tell her everything about the wedding," I said. "We used to talk about everything. I wanted to let her know about you, me, and Ladere."
"What would you tell her, Daddy?"
"That I thought we were going to be all right," I said.
"Better than all right," Leah said. "We'll be great. We'll be a family."
"You've always wanted that, haven't you, kid?"
"Uh-huh. But I wanted it for you more than me. You were so lonely, Daddy. I couldn't stand it that you were so alone."
"I should have hidden it better."
"No one else knew it," she said. "But don't forget, I'm your girl. There's not much I don't know about you."
A car pulled up to our building, and we watched Ladere and my brothers get out of it below us. Dupree and John Harden stripped down to their underwear and climbed in the great fountain and began swimming, Dupree going underwater and John Harden doing the backstroke. Leah broke free from me and ran down to join Ladere, who held their clothes. I laughed to myself as I watched my brothers enjoying their illegal swim. T and Dallas came out the front door with Leah, and T plunged into the deep fountain without even removing his suit. Leah joined him in her party dress, and I watched it all unfold below me in a world that seemed far away, yet very dear. I began to fade out in this dream of a world, with the rest of my life spread before me. I was grateful for so many things that they seemed uncountable. I wished my mother and father could have been here to share this evening with me. I tossed out a prayer to Lucy, and I thanked her for loving me as well as she could. She had cherished me in her own way, and she had made me feel kingly in a town where they had once laughed at her. I gave thanks to my brothers and my friends, my hometown and my home state, and my love of good food and travel and strange places. There was a fullness to my life now I was just recognizing. I had come to Rome a hurt and Shiloh-haunted man, and I knew now there were worse things to be. I heard the voices of those I loved laughing in the piazza below. I thanked the world for bringing them to me. Then I gave myself for a last time to Shiloh Fox and let her spirit wash over me and forgive me my happiness. I thanked her to myself and apologized that I had to leave her now. Though I did not speak out loud, I told her that I had been as true to her as I knew how to be, and that I would never have left her, no matter how grievous her suffering or permanent her scars. Closing my eyes, I filled up with my incurable need for Shiloh again, my love for that girl who used to approach me through the secret, leafy avenues of an oak, who reconfigured my entire world by opening up the deposits of her soul for my inspection. "Jack!" I heard a voice call from down below me, and it surprised me, but there was my wife. Looking down, I saw that Lydia had joined her new family, swimming in the dazzling fountain. She had always been a beautiful swimmer, and she was side-stroking with Leah beside her. Her wedding dress clung to her, and my brothers and daughter waved for me to join them. I caught a glimpse of my left hand, and was surprised to see it change forever with the ring that Lydia had bought and placed on my finger that day. I touched the new ring, and it felt very much like new life. Before I went down to join Lydia and the others, I remembered my appointment and I smiled, knowing that one day Shala and I would be together again. Because she had promised it, and because she had taught me to honor the eminence of magic in our frail human drama, I knew that Shala was waiting for me, biding her time, looking forward to the dance that would last forever, in a house somewhere beneath the great bright sea. This concludes the reading of Beach Music by Pat Conroy. This book was read by Jonathan Mayrose.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.